I am Roy Malloy, and you're listening to The Dawn of Crime. This is a podcast that I've dedicated to trying to unpack the biographies, the people, the places, the culture, and the time in that catchment period of 1890s to 1930s, where Australia was finding itself in a whole number of ways, but the criminal underclass and the marginalised were also exploiting every crack in the armour of society's law. In particular, I look at organised crime in that time period, and in particular in organised crime, I'm always looking for those stories that talk about the less usual players. So they're the women and the children and the First Nations stories, the trans and the gay stories. I find them to be the most interesting because they are also the most complex and richly human in a lot of ways. I'm going to talk a little bit about sly grog shops in this podcast, and I get asked the question a lot on my social media, and I post a lot predominantly to Facebook, less so to TikTok these days, but I've got a few videos on TikTok. But on Facebook I talk a lot about sly grog shops in general, and I have a few international followers, and they ask the question, what is a sly grog shop? And there's the three words, the sly meaning illegal or, you know, hidden. Grog is an Australian euphemism for the word alcohol, and shop being the place that they sell it in. And it, in American contexts, it's the word would be bootleg. So it's a bootleg bar, I guess. And that's the simplest way to put it. It is illegal alcohol made for the sale in an unlicensed venue, but because it's unlicensed, there were active police of sort that were getting around, and they'd shut them down instantly if they found them. And so sly grog shops were always hidden away from the watchful eye of the law. And then that also then it paints the picture of where are they, because when you're conducting business in this time and place, and I'll probably use Fitzroy and Richmond as good examples, in the geographic makeup of Melbourne, where it's kind of, they happened everywhere. There were sly grog shops everywhere around the country, but Melbourne, a little bit more than Sydney in some ways, was just a little bit better organised. Sydney also geographically, if you're ever in Sydney, you'll notice very quickly that 30-year period of development that Sydney has over Melbourne. Melbourne's founded a little bit later than Sydney, and Sydney has roads that are they're kind of reactively planned. And so when they were developing Sydney, they kind of, well, we need to go there, let's put a road there. We need to go there, let's put a road there. Whereas by the time they got to Melbourne, they had the foresight to say, look, let's plan better. And they, a fella called Hoddle, H-O-D-D-L-E, Hoddle made a map that was a grid, and it was structured with wide streets that could take on huge amounts of traffic in the future. And these are problems that they learned in England as well, that, you know, they had these ancient Roman streets that were now almost unusable for anything more than two people walking, kind of thing. So they were very keen to plan Melbourne really well. Sydney became very difficult to get around, and so there really were a lot of sly grog shops and all the usual things, but there wasn't the ability to organise it as well. Like, you became very local in Sydney. If you're a gangster, a push gang, if you're a criminal, you know, you'd really stick to your area a lot more, and the areas were smaller than in Melbourne. So if you're in the Rocks in Sydney, which is a very, very small area beside, kind of across the water from the Sydney Harbour, the Sydney Opera House, the Rocks is very small, but you'd stay in the Rocks, you know. Whereas in Melbourne, Fitzroy is quite a large area. Richmond is quite a large area, and they are the two suburbs that kind of hug Melbourne's periphery. You've got Fitzroy to the north and Fitzroy and Richmond to the east. And they were kind of the stomping grounds for two very separate factions of crime. And Fitzroy was owned, I use the word owned, it was overseen, I don't know, it was under the watchful eye of a fellow called Ted Whiting. And Ted was a celebrity level boxer. He was Australian welterweight champion twice. I think he won 11 belts in his career. And having said that, a belt is, it's obviously a prize, but it's, there's like a belt that's a prize, but there's also the belt that is recognised as a national title. And so two of his belts were truly nationally acknowledged as, you are the best welterweight boxing champion in this country at the moment. And then he won other belts that were prizes, but he was the kind of famous that you're walking down the street and you're signing autographs and you're people patting you on the back, they recognise you at a glance. And he would train in a gym, for example, and 150 people would line up to see him train. So we're talking proper celebrity here, and in that day, even more so. But it's kind of, the way I read his career, it's like he finished finished boxing, and he said to himself reflectively, what will I do with the rest of my career? I'm going to go back to Fitzroy, where he was born, and be a standover man. And he did. He went back to Fitzroy, and he pretty quickly put in place measures with his brother Bunny, B-U-N-N-Y, like as in the rabbit, Bunny Whiting. John Bunny Whiting. And John was trap and sell the carcasses of rabbits. So Ted and Bunny, they set up an industry in Fitzroy where they put the clamps on legitimate businesses, where they'd walk in and say things like, let's say, be a shame if anything happened to your windows, you might want to pay us so we can keep the riffraff away. Right, it's extortion, and if you didn't pay, your windows would be broken. So they had that going on, but they also were entrepreneurial and enterprising in the way that they would set up Sly Grog shops as well. Now, in conjunction with Sly Grog shops, you never get them singularly. I've never seen a context, or I don't feel I've seen a context in the hundreds I've researched, where you just get this dwelling and people walk in, have a drink, walk out. Now, we have that with bars now. You go to these great little dive bars in Fitzroy, and that's the nature of it. You walk in, you order your drink, you enjoy it, you leave, right? But that's not the case with Sly Grog shops. And certainly they had pubs, and pubs were exactly that. You walk in, you have your drink, you leave. But Sly Grog shops break apart a little bit from that, in as much they, where you get one illegal vice, in this case, illegal alcohol, you're also going to get the raft of other things that go with that. You get prostitution, which also overlaps to underage prostitution. Ted's own sister was arrested for prostitution when she was 14, and she was returned home. And so this isn't unfamiliar to Ted. He's very, I don't want to say comfortable, he's very familiar, perhaps, that's probably being kinder, with prostitution, the use of underage girls. In that context, there's sexual assault, certainly. And then you also get things like guns and not in huge doses, but you do get cocaine. And I'd have to imagine, then you get two up and gambling as well. So anyway, you get the one, you kind of get all imaginable illegal stuff. And so then you're not just hiding now the sale of illegal alcohol. And the world was pretty uptight about alcohol back then, to the point where we have Dolly Gray, and Dolly Gray was the first wife of Squizzy Taylor. She was infamous in her day. She was really very, very well known, and she was working in Bendigo, very organized criminal. She was she didn't just rent buildings and run them as brothels. She also bought them, so she physically owned a couple of properties. She's a very smooth operator, but she was arrested with an equally well known prostitute named Hetty Williams, H-E-T-T-Y, short for, I believe, Henrietta. And the pair were arrested for kind of leaning out the front window of a brothel that they shared in Bendigo. And as men would walk past, they'd say, hey, come inside, buy us a drink, shout us a drink. And the men would come to the window, they'd talk. If the girls are successful, these men would come inside. They would tell the men that the beer they're going to give them is very expensive. They need to pay them for the beer, but what happens next is unpaid, right? So they're only paying for Sly Grog if they ever get caught. One of the cases went to court, and the judge was about to give his verdict, and he was charging her for the sale of illegal alcohol. And the prosecution said, but are we going to overlook the fact that she was living off the proceeds of prostitution? And more or less, the judge just said, oh, well, boys will be boys, but the sale of alcohol is very, very serious. So they were really worked up in this day and age about alcohol, but less so about sex exploitation in those kinds of forms. So, you know, when you come to a Sly Grog environment in Fitzroy and Richmond, you get this situation where if the police really wanted to, they could find them. They probably have bigger fish to fry, And I do dare say a lot of the police were also on the graft and turning a blind eye for a couple of dollars here and there. Certainly in Sydney, we get the story of John Wren, told in Power Without Glory, and he talks about, you know, paying off the police as well. So with Sly Grog in general, you've got this situation where they need to set up venues with a roof over their head where they can sell illegal alcohol and then take a skim off the top of all those other things that are changing hands. In that context, they're pretty guarded, I guess, and you'd need to know someone who would show you where the right one is. And you probably weren't safe if you just strolled in yourself. And so with that in mind, you kind of need a referral, I guess. And they would... I've also been able to unpack that at least some of the Sly Grog shops, and they'd probably be the bigger ones, had staff that included a cook, a bartender, a security guard at the door. They weren't just some dude in a back room. They were pretty well organised. And that takes, I guess, leadership at some level. And that's where we come back to Ted Whiting in Fitzroy and Squizzy Taylor with his mate Henry Stokes in Richmond. So with these kinds of venues, you'd find your way into one. But the shape that they, the shape and form they take isn't like a shop in a main street. It's not a house. More often than not, there were a lot of slum dwellings where you got situations where people came to Australia, made a fortune, left, and they had property they owned here and just did nothing with. There was a lot more coming and going from England back, or back to Europe in general. So you get these people, they come, they have property here, and they just leave. And it's in the will to someone, but they, you know, it's a long process to write a letter. It's a 3-week process at the bare minimum to get any kind of message out here. And so you get these properties all around the inner older suburbs of Fitzroy and Richmond that are, they're condemned, they're boarded up, they're also falling into wreck and ruin. When I'm researching the stories of these people, I constantly find addresses attached to them. So you get this crime committed in an address, and then when you go to Street View, they're almost never still standing. When you're researching other things and they talk about, you know, a women's auxiliary held at this address, same time period, those houses will be. So you've got the houses of the wealthy are maintained well, the upkeep, the you know, and they survive to the modern day on a lot of the in a lot of cases, whereas the houses where the crimes are taking place are already falling down in 1900 to 1930. So they're in kind of dilapidated, squalid environments. Add to that a few layers here. No plumbing. Now, the no plumbing bit gets me every time. The sanitation in Melbourne was pretty average at that time anyway. There's a lot of animals. So horse-drawn stuff is the obvious one, and you get horse poop. Horse poop does have ammonia, and it does smell. Horse urine as well. If you've ever seen a horse pee, it's a lot. And so on the streets, you've got this excrement already pooling, but there were dogs and cats in volumes that were just unchecked and unfettered. I grew up watching cartoons in the late 70s and 80s where those Hanna-Barbera cartoons and the Warner Brothers cartoons, they had the cat catcher and the dog catcher. You know, that guy with the great big net? That's not like a farce. They were things. There were proper dog catchers because there were so many dogs really towards the end of World War II that... They were just everywhere, and they were bringing disease, they pooped everywhere, they were bad news for hygiene. So you get this situation where there's excrement everywhere. Let's add the next layer down is probably rats and mice, and where do you get them? In a dwelling that doesn't have secure windows and doors, and that's these. So you got that stench everywhere. People didn't wear deodorant really until the late 1920s. Their bodies just stunk, and the poorer they were, the less clothes they had, the less they washed their clothes. People didn't usually wash their clothes like we do. So what you get the situation where they'd wear a shirt, and a linen shirt, let's say. They'd hang it up overnight outside and air it out. And airing out a shirt actually does remove a fair amount of the smell to the point where you could wear it the next day and it wouldn't be too bad for half the day. But by the end of that next day, particularly if you're working and sweating, the smell from the previous day and the smell from the next day, they both add up. And it's really pungent. It's a different kind of BO. So it was unavoidable. There was really weren't many options. And you get this situation in those kind of times and communities where people have an expression for it. They say, he smells of work. And it's almost like a feather in your cap. It's a credit to you if you smelled of body odour that you were you must be a hard worker kind of thing. But people stunk. And the kinds of people that went to sly grog shops were the kinds of people that stunk, men and women. You don't just get men at sly grog shops either. You get plenty of women, and not just prostitutes. It's the kind of place, it's a community place as much as a pub. And so you got this environment where people also probably, in most cases, if it's a condemned building, don't have access to an outhouse. If they do have an outhouse, and to make that picture a bit clearer, an outhouse is a thunderbox. I don't know what else you call it. It's a freestanding booth in the back of the yard, and most of those backyards backed onto a small laneway that was paved with cobblestones. And those laneways were called service lanes or night cart lanes. And the night cart was a horse and cart that would come by as a dray. A dray is a two-wheeled kind of wagonish horse-drawn vehicle. So the dray would come past the night and had a great big tank on the back. And the night soilman, or the poo man, would open the back door to your toilet outhouse through a little flap. The flap was maybe knee-high on a hinge. He'd lift it up. He'd pull out the bucket in which all your excrement had been, I'm going to say deposited. That's the polite word I'm going to use. It's been deposited over the last 24 hours. And he'd carry it on his shoulder and tip it into his tank and then take that to the sewer. So that was the arrangement. Now, that required payments of like council rates. You had to not be a member, but not far from that. You had to, and they knew who was paying and who wasn't. So if it was a condemned place, they weren't going to take your outhouse waste. So you got a situation where people are probably initially doing their business in the backyard, just on the ground freely. Add no toilet paper to that. Okay, so this isn't an environment where anybody's changing the toilet paper. So then you pull your dacks up. You see where I'm going with this, right? It's gross. But then after a bit, there's also stories about two instances I'm aware of, at least, where the floorboards inside these dilapidated condemned buildings were rotted because people have been peeing against the walls in the building, and not many things will erode wood and like disintegrate floorboards faster than urine in a wet, damp, unventilated environment. So that was the case. You got these gross. If I could go back in time, there's plenty of things I'd love to see. A sly grog shop isn't one of them. I have no desire. They're so absolutely gross. So that's the environment of the sly grog shop. And you get this situation evolve where it doesn't just foster illegal activity, it really fosters incredibly poor health. One character that I'm researching at the moment for a full biography is I'll say she's a pretty medium player in organised crime at this time. She's got some cut-apart features that really make her worth looking at. Her name is Minnie McKillop, and she also becomes known as Minnie Dean. She becomes known as Minnie Clark. She's born as Minnie McKillop. She marries a guy called Edward Campbell Dean, and then her name becomes Minnie Dean. Edward Campbell Dean takes the alias John Clark. So that's his pretend name, his gangster name. And she takes the name Minnie Clark as a result. So I will call her Minnie Clark because that's what she seems to prefer, and enough that she, when she's arrested a few times, she gives her name as Minnie Clark, and that's what's on her criminal record. So in referring to her as Minnie Clark, she's a prostitute and a sly grog manufacturer. Now, the bit where she can make sly grog, and I'll go into that in a minute, what that is, the actual kind of alcohol, where she can make sly grog, it makes her highly desirable as a staff member for other gangs. And you get this kind of tussle between Squizzy Taylor in Fitzroy, and then later with Ted Whiting in... Squizzy Taylor in Richmond, and then Ted Whiting in Fitzroy. They have a bit of a to and fro in regards to her both wanting her services. She can do a few things, Minnie. She can manage more than one venue in the form of a brothel at the same time. Now, I imagine that takes a few shapes. I think she was always working actively as a sex worker. Her husband and she, like Squizzy and his wife Dolly, you get a lot of circumstances and instances in this time of period where you get a male criminal who's actively a criminal, not just a you know, passive kind of passing thief. These are guys who are organised. They wake up every morning, they burgle houses, they pickpocket every single day for anything they buy. That's where the money comes from. They have these polyamorous relationships with their partners who are sex workers, and they also very freely have girlfriends. So it's, this is that, that exact arrangement. So she's working as a sex worker, and she does, she's one of the few that appears to do this over and over again, at least partly by choice and preference, which I find interesting. But she works in these exact kinds of slavery environments. For a lot of her time, though, she lifts her game, and she rents nicer houses, so proper houses in Fitzroy, in St Kilda, in Richmond. And it's while she's in Richmond for 5 or 6 years that she's probably working under the eye of Squizzy Taylor and his guys, and that means they're paying protection money, they're probably supplying girls and seeking girls from the net, the broader network of other brothels in that area, also under Squizzy's watchful eye. And she's making alcohol for him. Now, the production of alcohol, that we get a reference in, she has a sly grog shop in St Kilda, and she's arrested with her team of employees, and the police come in and they reference that there were bottles littered everywhere, empty bottles all over the floor. Every place where there was a wall, there was a line of bottles either laying or standing up. And then in amongst that, there was 100 or so bottles of full bottles of alcohol as well. So with all that, you know, on display and there, you get this situation where they are drunk most of the time. But the alcohol she's making is referenced in a newspaper article where they say that there was a large tin tub on the side of the room. So we're kind of looking at what she's making. It's ale, and we know that it's ale because it's referenced in several places alongside other big scale sly grog manufacturers like Bridget Mahoney, and the people who are making alcohol are almost always female. There's a lot of reasons for that. It extends partly to the fact that if a woman was arrested, they were usually treated with a lot more lenience than men, and they weren't sent straight to the prison. They were cautioned, fined. And a blind eye was turned a lot more to a woman than a man. They certainly did go to jail for it, and she ended up going to jail for it. But the prostitution bit tends to not be the thing they pursue. It's always the alcohol. So she's making alcohol in a bath. How do you describe that? The bath, it's a tin bath. It's big enough for a human to sit in with bent knees, and the water would come up halfway up your waist, almost to the top of your knees. I imagine we're probably looking in that, in the vicinity of 100 litres, and so with a long neck bottle being just under a litre, you're probably looking at 150 bottles every bath. And ale isn't difficult to make. It's if you want it to taste good, it's a little bit more difficult, but to make it alcoholic, it's not that difficult. It's just crushed barley or wheat with something that makes it bitter, and I'm aware that they use a variety of things that started with Cape gooseberries, which are kind of a tangy, citrusy kind of fruit, and they'd use them on occasion all the way to hops, and just molasses or sugar. Now, that she was also arrested later in her career with her husband, and the police charged them for illegally having sugar. So when they had their house raided on suspicion of something completely unrelated, the police found these great big tins of sugar. Far more sugar than any family should have. They said, well, we make confectionery. And they did. They had a candy shop in Port Melbourne on Bay Street. And I believe, I'm not certain of this because I haven't found the evidence, but I believe that they had a candy shop front that opened into a sly grog den at the back, like a real speakeasy kind of thing. And without question, Minnie Clark just becomes this this integral figure that she's everywhere she appears and every place she's arrested. She just unpacks the story of what it was like to sell sly grog, who was selling it, how much they were selling it for, where they were selling it, and so many bits and pieces that we're able to deduct from that time and place come from her role and the places she's arrested and who she's arrested near. And we don't find out much about her outside of that because these kinds of people, they make a real habit about not being found. As career criminals, they make avoiding detection a key part of who they are. I'm going to leave this this recording with a couple of really fun little stats that I found. And these come out in 1918, and so the Fitzroy Vendetta was really just starting to rev up. It was towards the end of 1918, and the Fitzroy Vendetta really does kick off in February of 1919. So it's only 3 months away from that all-out incredible skirmish that Squizzy Taylor led through most of 1919. And we see a whole bunch of discussion happening around the sly grog that was being sold in and around Fitzroy. And we get a number of key figures who are the inspectors, the alcohol and gaming inspectors for that time, and they're talking about where sly grog is. They begin by saying that 1916 and the beginning of 6 o'clock swill. Now, for those of you who are not from Australia, in 1916 during World War One, the government introduced what we call 6 o'clock swill, and it was a prohibition that made the sale of alcohol illegal after 6 p.m. And so, predominantly men, but people would rush to the pub after work finished at 5 p.m. and they'd drink as many pints as they possibly could in that half to three quarters of an hour, and then they'd go home. But it kind of left the rest of the night vacant for any kind of consumption of alcohol, so that they tended to find people like, exactly like Minnie Clark, who would make alcohol illegally and sell it to them. There was a huge rash of sly grog shops that emerged in 1916, and the licensing inspectors shut them all down very quickly, and they got them to a point where they'd kind of pushed them into one concentrated little area, which just happened to be Fitzroy. So Superintendent Davidson, who was the license in charge of, you know, alcohol licensing, he talks a little bit about Fitzroy, and in particular Little Napier Street. Now, we also see Minnie Clark arrested a couple of times in Little Napier Street. It features pretty heavily in her world. We also see Valentine Keating, the one-legged crutchy push gang leader, running a sly grog shop in Little Napier Street, probably for Ted Whiting. We see Ted Whiting's brother, Bunny Whiting, running an operation in Little Napier Street, and it was a hovel of a place. And he says that he desperately wants the condemned and lower class businesses to be shut down, bulldozed, and made into factories or new homes. And so we're looking at a period between 30th of September 1915 and 30 September 1918 that he's, you know, talking about what he's done. And he talks about that they've made 135 raids on sly grog shops in that time, with 98 convictions. Now, the liquor seized was only 84 bottles of spirits, 325 bottles of wine, 1,450 bottles of beer, with fines that together added up to £2,170. Now, when you average that out to explain how much alcohol there was, you're only then looking at 10 bottles of beer on average at every raid that they conducted, 2.4 bottles of wine, and the occasional bottle of spirit. It doesn't seem like a lot, and I've just got to really stress again, society was absolutely in panic mode, full panic mode about alcohol. They'd tolerate violence, they would tolerate so many things, but alcohol to them was the devil, and we don't share that this day, right? So it's kind of hard to explain how worked up they would get about alcohol. So to the point where they would waste the resource of half a dozen policemen for the night to go and raid someone's back room, like their garage, literally, for 10 bottles of beer and 2 bottles of wine. But it also talks a little bit about the ability the gangsters had and the sly grog manufacturers to understand where they're going to spread the risk on their operation. They weren't stocking huge amounts of alcohol in different buildings. They would take them probably each day, they'd get a supply, and they'd deliver it like the milkman would. So there's a little bit of an understanding that the raids were happening so frequently that they weren't stocking huge volumes of alcohol in their premises. The fun last little bit I'll close with is that the police not only raided these places, but then they resold the alcohol at auctions afterwards, from which they raised about £100. So, you know that old idea where they confiscate something and then use it themselves? I'm not sure that's exactly what was happening, but there's certainly evidence of police being bribed and paid off by crooks at this time. So there's probably a little bit of column A and column B happening. Guys, I've really enjoyed this. I've really enjoyed sharing some of this incredible stuff on social media. I have a Facebook page, which is probably where I put some of my more involved stuff and research, which is Roy Malloy Author. And that's, you've got to put the word author at the end or you end up with something else. And spell my name, M-A-L-O-Y. Otherwise, again, you end up with something else. And also, I'm on Instagram. I have a TikTok page where I do the occasional video on this kind of content. And if you are interested in this stuff, you might enjoy my published stuff. So head over to Roy Malloy Author, and there's links to my published works, which are The Dawn of Crime, The Squizzy Taylor Biography, The Dolly Gray Biography, and a couple of other exciting things coming out later this year. If you have any thoughts, do post them to me, send them to me via social media, any of those channels. Send me a message. I love hearing your stories, and take care.